Welcome to Forward Thinking, a podcast from Foundation Source. I'm your host, Dori Krieger. Foundation Source is the nation's largest provider of comprehensive support services for private foundations, bringing unparalleled knowledge and expertise to over 1,200 clients across the country. The best ideas in philanthropy aren't always the tried and true. Trailblazing entrepreneurs and next-generation philanthropists are transforming the sector with inspiring ideas and innovative strategies. Join us as we explore the advice, experience, and insight of some of the creative minds shaping our collective future. My guest today was named by Forbes magazine as a notable emerging philanthropist on their Ones to Watch list back in 2012. Today, she still consistently uses her resources to make change in distinctive and innovative ways. Catherine Lorenz is president of the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation, a private foundation established by her grandparents that focuses on sustainable, high-impact projects at the nexus of environmental protection, social equity, and economic vibrancy. For many decades before their passing, Cynthia and George Mitchell planned to leave most of their wealth to charity. When George signed the Giving Pledge, sponsored by Warren Buffett and Bill and Melinda Gates, he made public their long-held private intent that the majority of their wealth would be donated to their philanthropic initiatives. Catherine, thank you for joining me today in the studio.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
How did you become president of your family's foundation?
Well, in a lot of ways, it was really timing. My aunt, who had run the foundation for 19 years, was turning 65. And she said, about a year in advance, when I turn 65, I'm stepping down. Who's going to step up? So a lot of it was timing. Some of my other cousins who might have been thinking about that were in living abroad or had young families and weren't able to raise their hands and put their names forward. I had started a nonprofit when I was 24 and run that for 6 years in southern Mexico. Then I'd done a course called the Philanthropy Workshop that was a three-week course in strategic philanthropy, and then gone to work for the Institute for Philanthropy working with other donors. So I was on a trajectory professionally that really set me up to be able to lead the foundation.
For many years, as you mentioned, you sat on the other side of the grant-making table. You started this nonprofit in rural Mexico. What is it about those experiences that helped you prepare to become president of the foundation?
I think that was instrumental for me in being able to understand how to make a difference. You know, I went to Mexico for the summer in 2002 and had enjoyed it so much and wanted to work more. So I moved back in 2003 thinking I would be there for a year. And I ended up being there almost 6 years and starting a nonprofit, which was not necessarily my intention. And in doing so, I think I learned what it is really like to try and make change. It's really, really hard. You go in with one idea and you realize that idea is a flop and you have to go a different direction, or you realize what it really takes to run a nonprofit rather than what funders want to hear it takes. And so in doing all the grant writing and working with other funders and trying to stay sustainable, I recognized how difficult it is to appease every donor and tell them, you know, they want to fund one thing or you're doing another thing, and how to stay strategic and mission driven and not stray from what it is you're trying to do in order to please donors, but also getting enough funding to be able to pay the bills. And so it's this back and forth. And primarily, I recognize that actually making an impact on the communities we were working with is very slow. And it takes a long time. And these are intractable social problems that if there was an easy solution, they wouldn't exist. And so you're dealing with all of these barriers to success, which is difficulty in addressing the issues, difficult solutions to those issues, not enough resources to invest in your institution to make it as strategic as it needs to be. And all of that takes time and resources and committed funders to helping you be successful. So when I change sides of the table, it's a lot easier to recognize some of these challenges that nonprofits are facing and how to help them as a funder reach their potential.
So it sounds like when you were running the nonprofit, it took a lot of discipline to stay true to the mission and what you were trying to do, you were trying to affect change.
That's exactly right. I think that is one of the most important lessons I learned. When you're looking for grants and you see an organization or foundation that will fund something that's almost what you do, it's very tempting to kind of tweak what you're doing to get that funding.
Right.
But if you do that too many times, all of a sudden you're doing a little bit of everything and not what you actually set out to do. And I felt really lucky in that we had for us what was a significant gift of $200,000 that basically got us through the first 2 years and allowed us to really set up what our mission was going to be and stay true to this strategy.
How would you describe your grandfather, his legacy, and how that relates to the style of philanthropy that you're practicing?
So my grandfather, I think of as one of the most visionary people I've ever encountered in my life. When he saw something or he had a vision for how the world should be or how something should happen, he absolutely did not let down. And, you know, even he died at age 94, and even in those last few weeks of his life was talking about what the world was going to look like in 80 to 100 years. He always had the future in mind and was willing to stand up for what he believed in and willing to take risks. And I would say he was probably the most stubborn person I knew. When he wanted something or he felt like he was right, he would stand up for it no matter who he would make mad in the process or who didn't believe in him, and really drive for what he wanted. And so in the foundation, we look at that as a driving motivator for how we operate. It's really important for us to keep that spirit of innovation and vision and standing up for what we believe, even in the face of opposition.
And I think sometimes that's really hard to do. Have you had an experience where you've been in that position of having to stand up for what you believe in, what the foundation believes in the face of opposition?
Quite a lot, but it's really based on the legacy of my grandfather. So he was in the oil and gas business, but was a really serious environmentalist for many years, you know, many decades before his passing. And that was really clearly his key philanthropic interest and what he dedicated his most philanthropic time and energy to during his lifetime. So he was always, you know, put in the middle of his industry and his, you know, the leaders in his industry and the people he worked with, who were often in opposition to the environmentalists who he also supported. And he was often a voice that was in between those that could either help negotiate between the two, or he would often stand up for what he believed in. And I think that's a perfect example of he was a serious environmentalist in a world that was not so inviting toward environmentalists. And so the foundation has had a lot of those similar positions in exactly those areas, primarily because we do most of our work in the environment and environmental sustainability. And there's a lot of criticism, of course, that, you know, we may or may not have a true reason to be wanting to fund in the environment. But I mean, it could not be truer to who my grandfather was and who we are as a foundation.
What are the big changes that you're seeing in philanthropy and with private foundations in particular?
Well, I think it's really interesting that I'm sure every generation thinks that they're going to do things in a different way and a better way and, you know, poo-pooing those that came before. I think realistically, time changes, circumstances change, and ideas for how to make impact change. And none are right or wrong. They're probably just right for their time. I see that my grandfather and many of his peers really believed in big institutions, investing a lot in universities, big institutions, and that was the way to make change. There's a huge swing now toward kind of small, lean innovation. And that's a big shift that is both good and bad. I think there's a lot to be said about new innovative ways to address the old issues we've been dealing with forever. I think there's a big change and shift toward wanting to things to be more lean and wanting to, again, like less overhead. I have a real issue with that. I think that to build the institutions that are going to address these issues, you need to invest in the institutions themselves. You need to pay people well. You need to have the resources available to actually do this. And so while I think some of these startup, innovative, little new organizations are great, which is one of the big trends, I think we need to be careful that we don't swing the pendulum too far in that direction and leave out the institutions that have created change for decades.
When you're talking about this whole lean phenomenon, you're talking about nonprofit being lean. So evaluating a nonprofit by the overhead that they have or their administrative costs.
Yes, both ways, actually. I know I just read a blog that was all about, you know, that foundation staff should be lean as well. There's a big push toward, you know, we don't have a highly staffed foundation. We're pushing it all to the grantees. There's a whole thing about we don't want to fund the grantees. We just want the money to go straight to the programs.
Right.
I just think you need to be careful and find a balance. Of course, you don't want extravagance for administrative costs and administrative functions. But you also need to invest in institutions. And, you know, the example I used earlier of the organization I ran in Mexico, we were able to stay true to our mission and have a lot more impact down the line because we were able to invest in a strategic plan and we were able to stick to it and say no to opportunities where we could have gotten more funding, but we wouldn't have stayed true to the impact we were really trying to make and able to have more impact down the line. So I think the leanness, that excitement about leanness goes everywhere. And I think that we just need to view that trend with caution. And same with innovation. While innovation can be great and is necessary because we haven't found the solution to many of these issues we're trying to tackle, we have found solutions to others and we don't necessarily need to innovate. We just need to fund them more effectively and better. So I think that, you know, there is this shift toward leanness that I think we just need to be careful about.
While we're shifting towards leanness and there's that conversation going on, what do you see that's lacking? Or is there something else that's lacking in philanthropy?
I think education, donor education, is one of the most important tools there is as a funder. Philanthropy is a journey and you get better at it as you go. It's like any business you start or anything you do, as you go along, you get better. You learn from your mistakes, you recalibrate and you keep going. So I think one of the biggest problems I see in philanthropy is not taking the time to learn about what you're trying to do and how you can do it best. At the same time, you do need to just kind of jump in a little bit. And so there's a balance there as well in terms of, you know, don't wait till you're an expert. You've got to get started somewhere. But taking the time and the energy to really learn about what you're trying to do and how you can have the most impact, I think is very, very critical.
But this whole idea of a funder needing to learn and then at the same time being risk-taking and jumping in and trying to have impact, trying to have a difference. And I'm thinking about Mark Zuckerberg and his $100 million investment in Newark Public Schools. And I was reading in the recent book, The Prize, how he is quoted as saying that that was supposed to be a learning opportunity for him, as well as sparking innovation, something that could be tested and then brought across the country to the public school system. And I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on that as that kind of learning opportunity as well as the risk taking?
Well, I think it's actually great that he was willing to take a risk and that he is looking at it as a learning opportunity, because while $100 million is huge to many of us, if you look at the size of what he's able to give away,
right,
it's not necessarily, you know, that he threw the whole thing away. He learned a ton. He did have a lot of impact, while it might not have been that impact he hoped for. And he learned in why he didn't have the impact he hoped for. So, you know, I think maybe he could have done a bit more homework leading up to it. Maybe he could have learned a little bit more before jumping in at such a large size. But I do think his willingness to take a risk and then admit that, you know, it wasn't the success he had hoped for, and here's what I learned and how I would go about it differently and advise others, when you go out to do this, this is what I would recommend based on my failures. I think we don't share enough about failures in philanthropy. And more importantly, we don't listen to the failures of others and we go and do the same things over and over. And so I think that while we're criticized for not sharing about our failures enough, I think it's more that philanthropists tend to not listen to others. They want to do it on their own and then the risk doesn't pay off.
And when you're also thinking about risk taking, so much of family philanthropy is private. There are private foundations. And while someone may not be Mark Zuckerberg with that high visibility profile, they may be the Mark Zuckerberg of their local community. Do you have any suggestions for a family foundation funder on how they kind of overcome that fear of the public weighing in on what could be a failure if they find it in themselves to take a risky grant making stand?
You know, I think this is really individual. Mm-hmm. Personally, I feel that transparency is always better. At the same time, others disagree and would rather just, you know, be anonymous or, you know, not have people know what they're doing. And I respect both of those. You know, again, I think, I mean, it's a little different, but if you have someone post a really ugly photo of you on Facebook, but it's one of 100, it's not that big of a deal. But if you, if there are no pit photos and it's the only one, then it looks really bad. Right. And I think of that a little bit in grant making, you know, what is every, what, you know, let's look at everything you're doing. And if one's a failure, if it's in the context of everything else that you're doing and it's clear why you did or didn't do something, I think it, it helps the story along in a way, and it makes the public kind of go with you in that process. But, you know, for some people, it's just not what they want to do. And I think that that should be respected as well.
I like what you were saying about almost removing the stigma of the word failure. Like, failure has a negative connotation, but if you use it for a learning opportunity, and if funders start sharing perceived failures or successes too, there's a lot of learning that can happen and help people be more impactful. And you mentioned that you like to learn from funders. How do you go about learning from other funders? How does that happen for you?
So I think peer networks are one of the most important learning opportunities and spaces for me. Depending on what you're looking for, whether you're looking for issue-specific guidance or just other peers, particularly for families, what have other families done? Again, I would say don't reinvent the wheel. I mean, there, you can go learn from all of these people and help leapfrog some of the problems mm-hmm. that you would have run into. And I can say that when I took on this role as president of the Family Foundation, I went and I interviewed as many people who worked in family philanthropy as I could, people that I could learn from, and tried to really ask them, what should I be thinking about? What are the obstacles I'm going to run into? How do you think we should structure the foundation and the decision making? You know, really learning from all of them. And it's not that you want to copy one or another, but mm-hmm. in having lots of information, it then makes it very easy to kind of pick and choose from what people are doing, what will work for our family and how we can implement that.
Has being part of the Giving Pledge influenced the foundation in any way, or how has being part of the Giving Pledge influenced you?
Well, I should say, in terms of the quantity of giving, as you mentioned, my grandparents had committed the majority of their wealth long before mm-hmm. the Giving Pledge was announced. And so to sign on to that was really no big difference. What I think the Giving Pledge has done, which I really admire, is get an expectation out there that if you have this amount of wealth, you are expected to give significantly. And I think that's having an influence. I think they've also done a really good job of being pretty explicit that having an impact in philanthropy is not easy, that this is a really serious job mm-hmm. and it's not to be taken lightly. And they are doing a lot at the Giving Pledge to convene and help the pledgers do better with their giving and learn from one another. So a lot of this peer networking that we're talking about, they mm-hmm. they do there.
One thing I know just from listening to you present at other conferences is the way the time you used with your grandfather to really help you prepare to carry on his legacy. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I took on this role as president when my grandfather was 92. And partially knowing that I was going to be the leader through the transition of his passing and the foundation increasing in size. And I thought it was really critical to understand what it was he wanted and how we could make sure that we were going to live out the dreams that he had for this foundation. And so my most important homework during that time was to spend time with him mm-hmm. and to ask him some of these questions specifically, but also just to spend time with him and hear his life stories and hear what motivated him to become so philanthropic and to want to change the world in the ways he wanted to. And so that was what I really did, was just spend as much time as I could with him. I had dinner with him several times a week. You know, toward the end, it got less and less. But it was an amazing time. And, you know, he had 10 children and 25 grandchildren. Wow. So there was not a time that I'd gotten to spend with him like right. that as a child. You know, when we were all together, there were lots of people running around. So to have an adult and professional relationship, but also to have a grandfather-granddaughter relationship around some of these issues around legacy and values were critically important. And lots of times I would actually video them or audio record them so that we could have some of what he was wanting to listen to later on and to remember. But for me, it was really just about time with him.
What a gift of time, too.
It was amazing.
And so do you think about those times when you would sit down and talk to him? And how is that kind of influencing where you are in the foundation now? You took over in 2011, is that right?
Yeah, well, they influenced it a lot. You know, what was very interesting is we have audio tapes going back to 1993 of
That's
him
great.
And my grandmother talking about what they wanted with the foundation. Then we did a series of videotapes when we did a strategic plan. And so if you look at that, that's, you know, spanning 20 years. And what's fascinating is what stays the same mm-hmm. and what changed. And you could see a lot in what stayed the same were around values and motivators and his real interest in sustainability issues. So fast forward, he passed away in 2013. And I can say that most of my work is around the process, guiding the family in the decision-making process, creating committees and creating structures and policies around how we make decisions and how we decide what to fund and where to go and how we create strategies. But as we go through this process, we are mm-hmm. coming through, you know, this plan with an idea of how we will really implement the dreams that my grandparents had and the vision they had for the foundation, combined with the family influence and the reality of today, and then how we will scale this up in the coming years.
So you have your work cut out for you.
Definitely. It's fun work, though.
Well, thank you. Thanks for giving the listeners your time today, kind of sharing your experiences and how you're approaching carrying on your grandparents' legacy. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
To learn more about this segment of Forward Thinking and our work at Foundation Source, please visit our resources page at foundationsource.com. While you're there, tell us what you thought of this segment and who you'd like to hear on a future one. We'd love to hear from you. Our podcast is produced by Gabrielle Galanek. I'm your host, Dori Krieger.